guessed, almost guessed.
He started, which I think my first class, he started giving Humashir on Rashi, which is where we have this farm from, on the, when the American Bachram came to Amir, and he saw that they weren't being spiritually, they didn't have the same approach to roughness, to spirituality, to matters of spirituality that a native-born European had, meaning a, somebody who grew up in Poland or Lithuania had a much more intense spirituality and connection with it than those who grew up in America. And so in order to impart, you know, sort of the fundamentals of belief in spirituality to the students coming over, and these were not, this was not like an outreach thing. It was the students who came to Mir from America were super serious, meaning if you were traveling from America to learn in yeshiva in Europe, you were, you had to be serious because the yeshivas in Europe, for the most part, had very, you know, not fun conditions to live in. If you're coming from America, where you have indoor plumbing and good food and everything else, and you're going to yeshiva where the indoor plumbing most probably didn't exist, the food was minimal, if you know, and what there was wasn't appetizing a large part, and it might not have even been that the yeshiva even had food. A lot of yeshivas had where you had to go out for your meals, and the inhabitants in town each signed up that they would host, you know, for lunch, this yeshiva bacha, that yeshiva bacha, whatever it was, which itself was uncomfortable. Reb Shach, who went through that system, he was bashful by nature. He didn't like to take from people, so he almost didn't eat, right? Because rather than having to go to people's houses, and especially in Europe where people didn't have, so, you know, they're taking their one plate of noodles and splitting it in half and giving you half of it. So it was uncomfortable for somebody who had a sensitivity to those things. So if you're coming from America to learn in Europe, you're obviously somebody who your primary objective is Torah. You care a lot. And even so, even those kinds of boys who were coming to Europe, Rabbi Yerucham felt they were missing something in their spirituality that was already present with somebody who grew up in Europe. So he gave them special shiurim in Chumash and Rashi. He thought that was, which we're learning, which is the best way to, he felt, to develop one's sense of spirituality. In fact, in Europe, there, just the day-to-day life was much different, and we tend to, certain spiritual elements of life have been taken over by the media, to the point where we now consider them nonsense, because obviously the media representation of them is nonsensical. So spiritual phenomena like a golem, right? The golem of Prague, which did not exist. However, it was taken up as one of the big Jewish legends, and it was promulgated, and now it's like a point of ridicule that somebody should believe in such a thing. There were golems throughout history, but not that one.
What time period are we talking here?
The Golem of Prague?
No, when you're talking about the yeshiva boys going over.
In the 1920s, 1930s?
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, Rabbi Victor Miller, who you might have heard of, died in the 90s, I think. He was a very prominent rabbi in Brooklyn who...
My neighbor.
Oh, okay.
When he was in Chelsea, Massachusetts,
for
8 years.
Okay. Yeah. So he went to Europe to learn, and he said that when you went to the outhouse, like to, on a bathroom break, you came back, you couldn't even go back inside to the base medrash of the yeshiva for 10 minutes. You had to like deodorize. It was so disgusting. So those people are very serious, and even so. And what caused that break? Why in America were people so dissociated from the reality of spiritual phenomenon, and in Europe they weren't? There was a real presence of spirituality in Europe that just didn't exist. So another thing that the media took a hold of, in like an old Yiddish theater, was the concept of a dibbuk. That when somebody's, how do you say it in English, that they're possessed by the spirit of another, how that happens, how can a, you know, a neshama, a wandering neshama somehow why does Hashem not allow it to ascend, and why does it go to another person, without getting into the whys of the matter. But it happened in Europe, and it was just accepted as a reality, right? That, okay, a Dybbuk, interesting, but it's like another Thursday, right? So it's not that big a deal. The Vilna Gaon, when he, in the 1700s, obviously famous for who he was, he needs no introduction, his mahalach, the way he conducted himself was during the day, even during the day, he would set up in his room with his farm, his gemar and whatnot, light a candle, and then close the shutters. He wanted zero distractions, no natural daylight, didn't want to know what was going on outside. He just wanted to focus on Torah, and that's what allowed him to become who he was. In fact, this was something that some people took issue with when he invited the Dumna Maggid to give him mussar, to give him reproof. So now you know who the Dumna Maggid is, like who's the grub, going to ask to correct him. It was the Dumna Maggid. The Dumna Maggid says, came in and he says, you come in here, it's all dark and the shutters are closed. That's not a kunz, that's not a trick. To become great, by shutting out the outside world, the trick would be to open your shutters and be involved in the outside world, and even so, be a very great personality. So the Vilna Gaon said, "You're right. I'm not here to do any tricks, right? I'm not a magician. I have to focus on Torah. So tricks are not my thing." And he felt to do that, he had to keep the shutters closed during the day, even. So once he was learning, a Dybbuk had occurred in Vilna, that some young man was yelling and screaming and possessed by a Dybbuk. And the townspeople were up in arms, and it caused a whole commotion. The Grud was not aware of it, and all he knows is he's trying to learn, and people are just yelling outside. So he opens his shutters to find what's going on, like what's disturbing him. So it turns out there's a Dybbuk. So the person who was possessed, when they saw the Vilna Gaon, the Dybbuk speaking through this person said, "Are you the famous Eliyahu who they declare in heaven that we should be afraid of him and his Torah? And if so, then just give me the word and I'll go away." And the Vilna Gaon, not addressing the Dybbuk directly, said, "I've never had any interactions with negative spiritual forces. I don't plan on starting now." And he closed the shutters. Rav Yerucham, we're talking about relatively modern times, 1920s, 1930s, he said when he was a bachar in yeshiva, there was also a Dybbuk that came to Radin, like a parent brought their child who had a Dybbuk in him to Radin, hoping that the Chofetz Chaim would take care of it. And the Chofetz Chaim was, he usually sent emissaries to do the job. But when the Dybbuk showed up in Radin, obviously it was, interesting. So people came out to look. There's always a taiva, especially when you're learning in the Beis Medrash, right, that something's interesting going on to, see what's happening, because it's more interesting than usually what's in front of you. It's a time, it's a desire. You should be focusing, but it's hard to suppress. Rav Aaron Cutler, that's all, used to say that even there's a concept of bittul Torah, not learning properly, even in terms of learning, that there's a taiva by yeshiva guys, a desire to go and schmooze with other guys in learning, but because they like conversations, not because they're accomplishing anything with that learning. He said you have to be vigilant about even that. Anyway, Rav Yerucham said about himself that he gave into the taiva. There's a Dybbuk in town, you want to see what's happening. So he said he went, and obviously today we poo-poo the whole idea. What do you mean a Dybbuk? It's not true. And when we think about what the Christians call possessed, we also tend to dismiss it. Obviously, sometimes, unfortunately, people have a mental illness, and they call it they're possessed. It's not true. They're just mentally ill. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about authentic religious phenomena. And Rabbi Yerucham said he went, and the townspeople had surrounded the person who had the Dybbuk in him, and all of a sudden this boy with the Dybbuk in him started telling everybody secrets. He like, "Reuven, you, I know what you did last night. And he said what he did last night. And Reuben like turned white and he ran away. Shimon, last week. And people were horrified and they ran away en masse, right? So because they didn't want the town in public to air their dirty laundry. Rabbi Yeruchim pulled out of that the Musar, meaning just to be confronted with one's own sins by a person, by a Dibbuk, how much more so when HaKadosh Baruch Hu, after 120 years, confronts us with our chatan. But the spiritual reality was authentic. It was just, it wasn't considered like something you would write home about per se. It wasn't something to make a movie about, just that's the reality, you know, a dibbuk. Even in more mundane manners, there's Rev Isser Zalman Meltzer Zatzal, who died in the 60s, I think. He was nifta in the 1960s. He was Rosh Yeshiva in Europe and then eventually made his way to Eretz Yisrael, where he was the Rosh Yeshiva of the Chevron Yeshiva. There's a halacha that when you buy metal or glass utensils, like a glass mug, not a ceramic mug, but a glass mug or a metal bowl or forks and knives and stuff, you have to tovel them. They have to go into the mikvah before they can be ready for use. And you're not allowed to use them until you dunk them in the mikvah. So that's why if you go visit the mikvah, it has a kelim mikvah as well, like a small room to the side, a smaller mikvah just for dipping your utensils in. So he could tell that somebody brought something to him. He said, but the cup hasn't been tovled. And they're like, how would you know that? And he didn't understand the question. He's like, what do you mean, how do you know? You look at the cup. Or the utensil, whatever it is. You imagine the name of Hashem on it, the Yudkei Vavkei, the four-letter name, and if it shows up clearly, then you know it's been tovled, and if not, not. And that was it. That just took that, like, how would you not know that? Like, so obviously the people were very surprised, and it spoke to who Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer was, A, that he could do that, and B, that he didn't find it odd that he could do that, that was just to be taken for granted. But it was a much different reality than the one we live in. Our lives are so devoid of a spiritual reality. We don't, meaning it's a sickness that almost causes itself. Once you're blinded, you don't even see anymore what you're missing. It just seems nonsensical. So that's pshat.
So what is the explanation that people get possessed? You know, like why?
Why? What's the question exactly?
So, according to the Torah, since this exists, why do people get possessed? What is the purpose?
There are certain averas for which a person, we don't understand these things so much, but heavenly matters. But as it's recorded this far, certain averas which require a little more, penance in this world before you're able to ascend and even go to Gehenna or anything else. It requires a little bit more work to be done here. And that, for those averas, if somebody committed those, or again, whichever averas it is and however you had to do them, that becomes a wandering soul that is seeking to do its penance in this world before it can ascend. And then the person who has the dibbuk go into them, usually there was some trigger. Again, they're not at fault. They didn't ask the dibbuk to come in. But another story with the Chavetz Chaim, which Rabbi Chanan Wasserman Zatzal was involved in, the dibbuk said that I'm going to cut the whole story, but he had entered a girl, a teenage girl, because the dibbuk had been in a trough of water and the girl had gotten sick. And she took a cup of the water, but didn't make a bracha beforehand. So he was able to transfer into the girl. I don't know about these things. They're mystical in nature. But I would say quickly learn through Shas and Zohar, and you'll get a sense of it. But there are rules about how it works.
It's better to be blind, I guess, right? They do that, right?
But you said a dibbuk is a soul.
Yes.
That is kind of wandering.
It takes a person's body, yeah.
A soul that takes over a person's body.
Yes.
A different soul than
a
your own.
A different soul, yes.
No, thank you.
Rabbi Chanan indicated that his, which was in the, I believe, believe is the early 1930s, was the last one, meaning he for what, again, whatever his proofs were, but that there weren't going to be any more before mission. So
no more Dybbuk's.
No more Dybbuk's. So Yeruchim says that's pshat in our next pasuk. If we look in the top pasuk, Vayom Hashlishi, top line in 102, Vayom Hashlishi was on the third day. Vayisa Avraham es Eina. Avraham lifted up his eyes. Vayaras hamakom erachok. He saw the place from afar, from a distance. So this was the place which Hashem had told him, go to the place which I will show you, and that's where it will happen, where you'll do the akedah. So he never, as we explained in the last two shiurim, he didn't tell Avraham where that place was. So how did Avraham know that this mountain was the mountain that he was supposed to be at? So if we look in Rashi, the third line in Rashi here, in the right-hand column, it says, Vayaras Hamakom, he saw the place. The hey in front of the word Hamakom indicates the place, meaning he knew that this was the place he was supposed to be. Ra Anan Kosher Alahar. So Rashi's quoting the Medrash here that he saw a cloud tied to the mountain, meaning it was surrounded by some type of heavenly Anan cloud, which Avram saw. He recognized that, and he knew that that was the place. If we go to the next pasuk up on top, Vayomer Avram Anarav. Avram said to the boys who were with him, the lads who were with him, Shvu lechem po im hachamor. Stay here with the donkey. Vani v'anar, and I and the lad, meaning his son Yitzchok, Neoch adko, we will go until there. V'nishtachavim, we will bow down. V'nishu alechem, and we will return to you. So the Medrash here says that Avraham asked Yitzchok. Avram saw the mountain, you know, with this heavenly cloud above it. He asked Yitzchak, do you see anything? And Yitzchak said, yeah, I see it plainly. And then he asked the other two who were with him, which, do you see it? And they said, no, we don't see anything. So he said, fine, you stay here with the chamor. Chamor literally means donkey, but the word chamor has a connotation of chamrius, of physicality. That when a person is engrossed in their physicality, they haven't yet transcended it, then it creates a kind of blindness in a person, that they can't see spiritual phenomena. Avraham and Yitzchak, who had already worked on themselves to enough of a degree that they didn't have that barrier anymore, the barrier of physicality, they were able to see, in real time, as it were, the cloud on the mountain. But the other two, they could not. So that's what Avraham was telling them, you stay here with the chamor, yet because you don't see, then you're equated with, the physical animal, and you have to hold back for the next part of the journey. Rabbi Yerucham points out that in those days, seeing, which obviously we see things, but seeing is just a minute physical representation of the koach, the potential of what a person can see. Shmuel HaNavi is described in Tanakh as Havroeh, the seer, and he was well known. It says it explicitly that before Shaul became king, he was in charge of his father's animals at some point, and they lost some animals, and the person who was assisting Shaul and taking care of the animals said, let's go to the Roeh, let's go to Shmuel, the seer, and he'll tell us where they are. And Rabbi Yerucham says this was not like a Torah thing. It wasn't because Shmuel was such a big Talmud Chacham, which he was. He was a Gadol Hador, but the mere fact that he had worked on himself and was able to transcend his physicality to such a large degree that his sight, he could see things that other people couldn't, even in the physical world, and he knew you would go to him, and if you lost something, he would tell you where it is. He could, so to speak, see where it was, just because he was no longer bound by the standard physicality. And we see this as well, that when a person passes on, they lose their body, and their ability to know, to see, becomes almost unlimited. The Gemara in Brachos records a story, which I think we mentioned before, that a certain righteous person who had a fight with his wife on Erev Rosh Hashanah, and he says he was so upset, he left the house, he went to the cemetery, and that night while he was in the cemetery, he overheard two spirits talking, two girls who had died recently, discussing, you know, their plans for the evening, as it were, in the spiritual world. And one said to the other, it's our Rosh Hashanah, let's go to the pargod, which the pargod is a mystical concept. Literally, a pargod is like a curtain, but the barrier, the curtain between, you know, Hashem's realm and the spiritual world and the, you know, outside of Hashem's direct realm within the spiritual world as well. I mean, even within the spiritual world, there's distinctions. So he overheard one spirit say to the other, let's go listen by the pargod and see, and we'll know what's going to happen in the next year. And why that affected them, I don't know, but that's what they said. And the other girl responded to her, the Gemara says, that I can't go. My body is still, you know, it still has substance to it. It's covered in a mat of reeds, which prevents me from traversing the spiritual world in the way that you can right now. You go without me and you can come back. You can tell me what you hear. So she came back. Eventually she said, oh, and this year, this is gonna happen, that's gonna happen, the weather's gonna be like this, people are gonna plant at this time, but they're gonna get ruined, there's gonna be, she went through like old farmer's almanac almost, as the Gemara has it. And the man heard it, so now he had the inside information, and he was able to plant at the appropriate times where everybody else, their economy crashed on them, but his was doing amazing. And it happened again another year, and his wife was very suspicious, like, why are we the only ones being successful? Okay, eventually the story came out. What Rabbi Ruham wanted to pull out from that, though, is he says, you see that these girls were not gedolim in any way, but the mere fact that they were no longer encumbered by physical body meant they could access information and see things, hear things, in ways that mortal people cannot. So that is what's happening here. Avram and Yitzchak, even in this world, they saw the spiritual significance to the mountain they were heading towards. Those who didn't, who still led very physical-oriented lives, they could not see it, and it was just a reality. And Avram said, here on in, it's only me and Yitzchak who can go forward. If we continue on in the next pasuk, pasuk vav, v'yikach Avram es atzei ha'ola. Avram took the wood for the ola. Ola is a kind of korban, meaning a burnt offering, which he planned on, you know, shechting Yitzchak and making him an ola. But yasama Yitzchak beno, and he put it on. He had Yitzchak carry the wood. Yikach biyado es ha'esh v'samachelas, and Avram took the fire and the knife in his hand. Vayelchu shneim yachdav, and the two of them walked off together. So what does that mean, together? Of course they're together. That's a superfluous word. So if we look in Rashi, right in the middle of that column, Vayelchu shneim yachdav, Rashi says they walked off together. Rashi comments, quoting the Medrash here, Avram shahaya yodea, Avram who knew shaholech lishchot es beno, that he was going to shecht his son, haya holek baratzon v'simcha, he was walking with the same will and joy, ki Yitzchak, like Yitzchak, shelo haya margish badavar, who did not have the same feelings. Now, Yitzchak didn't know what was going to happen, the Midrash says. Obviously, as we're going to see from his question, but their emotional response was the same. Avraham was walking, I don't want to say unencumbered, he was, but he had the simcha to do the Ratzon Hashem, to do Hashem's will, as did Yitzchak. And they walked off together with that emotional countenance. But then something changed. In Pasuk Zion, Vayomer Yitzchak el Avram Aviv, Yitzchak said to Avram his father, Vayomer, and he said, Avi, my father, Vayomer, hineni v'ni, I'm here, my son. Vayomer hinei ha'esh v'etzim. Here's the wood, here's the fire, Vayeha Sala'ola, but where's the sheep for the offering? Vayomer Avraham, and Avram said to him, Elokim Yerlo Hasah La'ola B'ni, that Hashem will, you know, show for himself, he'll see where the sheep is for the offering, my son. Vayelchu shneim yachdav, and once again, the two of them went off together. The Medrash here says that Yitzchak's sudden change in attitude is because the Samael, which is the name of, so to quote unquote, the bad angel, which represents the Yetzirah, the evil inclination, chose at this point, as Avraham and Yitzchak were walking together happily, as it were, to do the Ratzon Hashem, to make his big play on both of them. Meaning, until this point, people were caught up in the emotion of the situation, like they were packing, it was stressful, it was tense, and so at that time you can't think as clearly. And it's not immediate, it's a few days hence. But now it was for real. They're walking, it's quiet, all you have, you know, to accompany you are the thoughts in your own head, and you're about to do something crazy, drastic, and by killing his son. So at this point, the Yitzhar makes its big play, the Medrash says, against Avram. And the first thought that entered Avram's head was, the Yitzhar told him, are you Meshuga? You have a child when you're 100 years old, and now you're going to kill him? How could that be? Like, that doesn't make sense. Obviously, whatever miracle happened that allowed you to have such a child, and the dearness of having a child at that age, how could you possibly contemplate what you're about to do? So Avram answered back, Almanaske, the Medrash says, meaning even so. Listen, Hashem said so. Obviously, there's some cheshbon I don't understand, some calculation. It's just, what am I supposed to do? Okay, I acknowledge it's crazy, but I'm going to do it. So then the Yetzirah hit him again. He said, well, okay, fine. You want to do what's the right thing, but what's going to be next? You think this is the last test? This is the final Nisayon? You have no reason to believe that. This is, you know, the next Nisayon. And after that, it's going to be even harder. And you already know that you're sort of, right? Avraham was besimcha to do Hashem's ratzon. He obviously was tremendously conflicted, though. It wasn't an easy task for him to do what he was about to do. The next Nisayon, whatever that would be, is most probably he's not going to be able to pass. Meaning if Hashem's upping the ante by every single test, then already this was the line, and Avram was just making this one. The next one, the Yitzhar told him, Dad, you're not going to pass. And I think you know that, he told Avram. And Avram acquiesced, yeah, if I'm having trouble already now, I'm able to do it, but it's hard. The next one, presumably, I'm not going to be able to make it. So Yitzhar said, so why not? Why not just say no on this one already? If you know you're going to fail in the future, then just give in now and save your son. And Avram said, Amenaske, even so. You're right, that's logical, but what am I supposed to do? Hashem said to do it, and I have to try to do what Hashem said. And the Yitzhar said, fine, but Avram, think about from Hashem's perspective. He gave you a job in this world. And in order to do your job, people have to look up to you. But if you go through with this, you'll have destroyed everything you've tried to accomplish. Forget your emotional attachments, fine. Forget about your personal loss, fine. But what about the work you did in this world? That's your whole point. If you wake up tomorrow morning having killed your son, everybody's going to know. And they're going to say, Avraham, oh, we thought he was a good guy. He's a murderer. He murdered his own child. Everything you tried to accomplish will disappear in a second. And then what? Then what will be with Hashem's place in this world? What will be with your reputation? What will be with your avodah of bringing people closer? Avraham said, Almanas came. Even so, what am I supposed to do? Hashem said so. So when the Yetzirah saw that it wasn't able to stop Avraham, the Medrash says it moved on to Yitzchak. And it knew it couldn't make the argument like, don't allow yourself to be killed, like, because Yitzchak was willing to sacrifice himself. That he already expressed that sentiment to Yishmael many years before. So the Yitzhar came to Yishmael to Yitzchak with a different argument, and it said, Yitzchak, okay, fine, very noble, very regal, you're going to sacrifice yourself on Hashem, but what about your mother? Does she deserve such a thing? She waited so long until she was 90 years old, you're the apple in her eye, how could you do such a thing to her? What is the emotional, catastrophe you're going to inflict on your mother? And Yitzchak gave a similar answer. What am I supposed to do? Hashem said so. He understands the consequences, and she'll get reward for being part of this process. So the Yitzhar said, fine, let's take that for granted. What about everything she worked for. It's one thing to say that you're willing to destroy what you worked for, but are you willing to destroy what your mother gave her life for? She gave her whole life for you, and everything she did was to elevate you and not elevate the negative elements in the world, which were represented by Yishmael. She stood up to her husband, she stood up to those around her, she cast out Hagar and Yishmael. She made sure that there was no negative influences that could affect you. And if you allow yourself to be killed, then Yishmael takes center stage. You're literally destroying everything your mother stood for and everything she was trying to accomplish. Are you willing to do that? And again, what Yitzchak was able to stand up to that question as well, saying, true, it doesn't make sense. Why has someone asked me to do such a thing? But he did so. So I have to. Now, the Medrash says, whenever the Yitzhar attacks you, it, as we see, it doesn't always win. You can stand up to it, but it wins somewhat, meaning it's able to turn something in one's head that now you have a question at least. You're not quite as happy, you know, to do the mitzvah as you were before. So Yitzhak, who previously had been happy to go accompany Abraham to the Akedah, but now that he had been attacked by the Yitzhar, who's making tremendously good arguments about why this Akedah shouldn't take place, it created the question Yitzhak's head as well. And now he's asking Abraham for reassurance. And he says, Abraham, you know, my father, where's the sheep? What are we doing here? Like, what's going on? And Abraham says that, again, the same answer, that he said, Elkim, that Hashem is choosing the sheep, basically. Like, if Hashem has chosen you, then there's nothing to talk about. Where are we going to stand in front of HaKadosh Baruch Hu? Rav Yerucham does point out here that there's a misconception, as it's portrayed popularly, that this was a nisayon, of course. It was a very hard nisayon, but Avram went with simcha, and Yitzchak went with simcha. From the Medrash, we see clearly it's true there was simcha, but there was also great emotional turmoil. This was not, they were ravaged by their yetzahara, by their emotions in this case. It was not an easy nisayon whatsoever. And that was the thrust of the nisayon, was they had to move past themselves in order to do the Ratzon Hashem. Rav Yashiv Ber Soloveitchik Zatzal also, he used to say the same thing. He was talking in the 50s, in the 1950s and 1960s when he spoke about it. But at that time, where, let's say, the religious elements in the Jewish American population were the minority, both in numbers by a large degree, but even with voice, people were writing off religious Judaism, Torah true Judaism, as, you know, having a few years left to live. And even religious people thought that they saw the direction that communal Judaism was taking with conservative reform in the greater American public, and it seemed like only a matter of time before Torah observant Judaism were to totally disappear. And one of the ways, or one of the common conceptions that existed in the non-religious world about religious people was that they were, silly and deluded to a certain degree, which you see in the popular media that was written by the irreligious, like Shalom Aleichem, and eventually as it was transformed into Fiddler on the Roof, but, you know, very much a conception of my beloved but crazy uncle, right? That it's nonsensical, and they have to get with the times, and we love them anyway, but it's all nonsense. And even for the religious people themselves, there was sort of a conception that they led blissfully innocent lives without having to deal with the real world. That when you have religion, all your problems are taken care of. And that's even an argument that you hear today, that, you don't think for yourself anymore, and that you're listening to what the Torah says to do. So that's obviously not the case. Rabbi Yashapir says it's clearly not the case. If anybody who is truly Torah observant understands the emotional, anguish that goes through in every single decision, it's a constant reckoning about, am I doing the right thing? Am I doing it properly? What should I be doing in this case, and sometimes the answers are ambiguous, which makes it even worse. The religious do not live, you know, an emotionally calmer life. They might be a much more fulfilled life, but it's certainly not calmer. And that's what the Medrash is saying about Avraham Yitzchak as well. The more extensive the Nisayon, their Shemiras HaMitzvos and Torah became, the more it pulled at their kishkas in order to observe it. If we continue on in the Pesukim, the Pasuk says, Pasuk Tes, Vayavo al Makom Asher Amar Lo, they came to the Pasuk which he said to, Asher Amar Lo Elokim, which God said to him, Vayiven Shem Avram Es Mizbeach, Avram first built the altar there, meaning before he continued, Vayarach Es Eitzim, he arranged the wood on it, Vayakod Es Yitzchak Beno, and he tied up his son Yitzchak, Vayasem Osal Mizbeach, and he placed him on the Mizbeach, Mima'al Le'etzim, on top of the wood, Vayishach Avram Es Yado, and Avram reached out his hand, Vayikach Es Ma'acheles, and he took the knife, Lishchot Es Beno, to shecht his son. So if we look in Rashi here, sorry, before we get to Rashi, how old was Yitzchak at this time?
39.
In his 30s. 39.
When,
37. He was 37. How do we know that? Because we know that how old was Sarah when she gave birth to Yitzchak?
90.
And we're going to see in the next parsha, which is called Chaye Sarah, it's right when Sarah dies, the parsha is going to say explicitly that she was 127 when she died. And Chazal say it happened consecutively, meaning Yitzchak, the Akedah happened, and then Sarah died immediately afterwards. So that would make Yitzchak 37 at the time of the Akedah. So this was not a child. It was a full-grown, mature adult who Avram was sacrificing on the altar. The Medrash says that when Avraham took the knife, that his eyes filled with tears, Einav Mars Dimos, that they were like dripping tears, V'nocho Dimos Le'enav Shal Yitzchak, and the tears of Avram fell into the eyes of Yitzchak. And Medrash says that even though Avram went besimcha to do the ratzon, but at the same time, concurrently, he was crying as well. And we'll see later, it's going to be in a few parshios, what the consequences of those tears were. But this is when it happened, is the tears of Avram falling into the eyes of Yitzchak as Avram's about to commit the Akedah. Then in the next pasuk we read...
Excuse me.
Yeah.
So I know this is a basic question, but so you said the Medrash says that Avram was like crying or his
yes.
eyes were full and everything and other things. So that's the Medrash... Is that the oral Torah, or is that the rabbis think that's what happened?
So,
we don't really know what happened.
How do we know what happened?
We weren't there.
How are Midrashim come about? So that's a good question. So the Chumash was given, and then, meaning Moses received the Torah in Har Sinai, at the same time he received the written Torah, he also received the oral Torah. Now, what does it mean he received the oral Torah, the meaning the Mishnais, the Talmud, the Medrashim, everything of that nature? He received a, this is a little bit up for debate, just in terms of, I don't want to get into it right now, but the nature of what he received and how he received it. But let's assume he, you know, sort of the common ground amongst the opinions, that he received a critical body of knowledge, as well as the tools to extrapolate from the Chumash, further facts. So if you're very sensitive to the Hebrew, which it's always a challenge when giving this kind of shir, because we're quoting Medrashim, which, as you point out, do not seem to be explicit in the Pesukim, so then where are they getting that from? If one has an appreciation for the nuances of the language itself, and a sensitivity to how to extrapolate those nuances, a lot of these Medrashim we would say are obvious, meaning which and it can't happen in English. We're all proficient in English, but the English doesn't in any way. It can't capture the nuances of the Hebrew language, Lashon HaKodesh specifically. Lashon HaKodesh and Chumash and Tanakh is written in such a way that it contains much within it. It's a almost, I don't want to say allegorical language, but the way it's written has so many nuances to it that anytime you translate it, you're collapsing all those nuances into one explanation, but not alluding to all the other explanations. Modern Hebrew is like English in that sense. It doesn't have any nuance in it. It's like the Hebrew version of English. But Lashon Kodesh and Chumash is not like that. And again, we don't have as a group enough of a background in Hebrew language to start explaining. The commentators definitely do. The Marzuk of Zev Wolf Einhorn is one of the major commentators on the Medrash. On every single Medrash, he shows how it's extracted from the Hebrew itself, the words of the Chumash. It would be very boring if I went through that because it relies on grammar and a knowledge of Hebrew, which we don't possess, and then just be like, okay, just move on. What does he say, actually? So, but it's there. You don't have to believe me, but I would suggest getting very comfortable with Hebrew and then looking into it yourself and see if it follows through. So then, if we continue, Pasuk Yud Aleph, 11, Vayikra Yilev Maach Hashem in Hashemayim. So just as Avram's about to shecht Yitzchak, the angel calls out from heaven, Vayomer Avram Avram, and he says Avram Avram, Vayomer, and Avram responds, Hineni, I'm here. Vayomer Al Tishlach Yadcha Onar, he said, don't reach out your hand to the lad. Va'al Tassalom Uma, don't do anything to him. Ki ata yadati, because now I know ki rei Elokim ata, that you fear God. Lo chasachta spincha es yichidcha, and you have not held back your son, your only one mimeni, from me. So Rashi here says, the last line in the first column, Yud Beis, atishach lishchot, don't reach out your hand to shechtem. Amar lo, Avram responded, imkein lachinam basi lakan. Did I come here for no reason? If I'm not going to accomplish anything here, why am I here? Esabo chavala, bozi menemata. Whatever the Akedah was supposed to accomplish, even symbolically, let's do it. Let me nick Yitzchak, at least extract whatever the blood was supposed to accomplish, and let that be, you know, in effect, what we did here. So Amale, the Maach said, no, atas lo mu'uma. Don't do anything to him. Meaning now we're seeing that the repetitive language in the pasuk is indicative of a conversation that Avram's having. Atas bomum, don't make a defect in him by cutting him. Kiati yadati, Rashi continues, again quoting the Medrash, Amar Rebbe Abba, Amar Le Avram said to him, Efar shufchana esichasi, let me explain to you, you know, what I'm saying here. Esmo, yesterday, Hashem, Amartali, you said to me, Kibi Yisrael Yikarecha Zera, Yisrael would be called your son, meaning he's going to be your progeny that will set up future generations. V'chazart, and then you went back, V'amart, and you said, Kachna Zabincha, take your son. Ach, and which meant, well, however it meant, but I was supposed to kill him, which would destroy the first thing you said. And Achshav, and now, Ata Omerli, you're saying to me, Atishach Yadcha Alnar. Don't touch him anymore. Meaning it's whiplash back and forth here. So Amar Lo Kadosh Baruch Hu, Hashem said to Avram, Lo achal brisi umotzei sevasai lo ashana. It's not true. I didn't profane the covenant I made with you, and I didn't change what I said. Kishamarti l'chakach, when I said to you, take, motzei sevasai lo ashana, I didn't change that. You were supposed to take him. However, lo amarti l'chashachteu, never said shachtim, that you'll never find that word explicitly when I told you, el halehu, rather you should bring him up. Asakte, achte, and then Rashi continues, ki ati adati, now I know, Hashem says, me ati yeshi ma lahashi b'sakta. Now I know how we can answer the saktan, bo'umos, and to the other nations, hatimei ma hi chi b'si atzlacha, why do I love you so much? Why are you the chosen people, as it were? Yeshli pishon b'asha. Now I have, what to say. Shemron ki yarei l'kemata, because everybody sees that you truly fear God. Okay, So this is obviously a loaded Rashi, and it contains deep ideas. I mean, your session will pick this up next time, explaining the implications of what Rashi's trying to tell us.
Yes. From this jock or something. Yes.